From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Four-day work week,
Four-day work week, Jim.
How good does that feel? And we love this place, and it's still how good does that feel?
You know, it doesn't take you much to get all excited, does it, Jim? Four-day work week. Oh, okay. My God. It's just the best.
Enough of that. You know, last time we spoke, John King had just arrived in Moore, Oklahoma. Today, he joins us from D.C. He's with us every Tuesday at noon, CNN's chief national correspondent, Dorchester's own. Welcome, John King.
You're not rooting for the Phillies this week, are you, John?
I have to say I am torn, John, to be as honest as I can. I am torn.
Oh,
sorry you asked.
I'm not torn.
Why are we not surprised about that, John King? So we saw you, Jim and I both saw you on TV talking to Wolf Blitzer about your visit to the Plaza Towers Elementary School in Moore, Oklahoma, where, of course, seven little kids were killed in that tornado. Tell us about that.
As the parent, I think it was the most difficult because you walk in and there's supposed to be a school there, and it was gone. I mean, it was gone. Think of a brick building, you know, shaped like a U, but the two arms are gone, essentially, and it's part of the crossbar, you know, of the U was left, and both of the corners of that are ripped at violently. And the chalkboard's hanging crooked on the wall, and there's debris everywhere. Some of it they had cleared out. When the first responders got there, and the officer taking me on the tour told me they showed up, and it was buried. The classroom of the school essentially collapsed on top of itself for the most part, and other debris from the neighborhood was blowing in and being dumped. There were cars in the area of the school that came from more than a mile away. I mean, this thing was carrying vehicles with it as it passed through. And as a parent, you just stand there and you just think, oh, my God. And look, you know, Moore lost seven members of its next generation at that school. Seven young children. But when you imagine, we don't know how many were there exactly, but on a full day, there are 460 students there, plus the teachers. Now, we don't know how many were sick, how many parents came to get them when they heard the about the storm potentially coming through. But think ballpark, 400 children. I hate to say this. I hate to say it. I mean, obviously, because seven families are mourning the ultimate, the most horrible thing you can think of. Parents are not supposed to bury their children. But if and when the other parents see what's left of that school, they are going to know how lucky they are.
You know what?
It's amazing to me that anybody got out of there.
When I watched some of the interviews on CNN that you and your colleagues did with some of the parents, it struck me the parents were saying the exact same thing that parents were saying who had a kid or a loved one at the finish line of the marathon, a kid or a loved or a kid at in Newtown. It's just that 30 minutes that they describe where they don't know if their kid is alive or dead is amongst the most moving, chilling stuff that one can possibly hear.
It's the worst. I remember trying to report on 9/11 when we were evacuated from the White House and, just trying to place my kids. They were in elementary school at the time, my two older ones. And just, I was pretty confident they were safe. They're out in the suburbs, but you're not sure, and you can't reach anybody, and the cell phone signals were jammed. And then the day of the marathon, my son's at Boston College now, and I didn't think he was there, but I just, I tried texting him right away. You're trying to do some reporting and help out, from D.C. I was in D.C. when it happened. You're trying to do some reporting and helping out, but your first instinct is, okay, I got a lot of family there, including my son. Let's make sure. And my sister-in-law, God bless her, started her network up there in Boston that day and made sure, everyone was accounted for, especially, the college, high school and college age kids who are out wandering around because it's the holiday. That, your first instinct is, is the human instinct, especially as a parent.
John King, speaking, and we're all parents, and I mean, even if you're not a parent, you certainly understand nobody wants to lose little kids. But one of the things I was amazed at, and correct me if I'm wrong, the initial reporting was that the children that were killed in that elementary school were killed when a cinder block wall collapsed on them. Is that correct?
That's part of it. I mean, they had, this form of asphyxia, which is caused by something violent hitting you.
Okay.
When it gets knocked out of you. And the cinder block walls came down. There's no underground. This was an older school, and this is going to be part of the conversation going forward. And the parents who lost these seven children, will be leading voices in this debate, I'm sure, to the point of, should it have had some sort of a reinforced tornado shelter. It didn't have a basement. Sometimes they build these concrete structures. You know, you see people, they're not quite underground. They're sort of half above and half underground. And there's a whole debate down there. If you go, again, it's like anything. It's, if you go to the West in the gun control debate, you get some views that if you're from the Northeast might shock you. There are a lot of people down there who, you know, are against these shelters or say they can't afford them or the ground is very soft and it floods. So they say there are, you know, architectural and logistical reasons that make them difficult or expensive. But you can bet. And the officer who was there with me who told me, you know, obviously these are his friends and these are parents, people from the neighborhood, everybody who rushed in there, I was horrified. I think especially when they rebuild a school, I don't think you're going to be able to rebuild a school in Moore, Oklahoma without some sort of a reinforced structure. These kids had nothing. They had to find the most secure interior wall of the building. And the teachers and the other administrators who, again, you know, Moore lost seven young heroes, but some real heroism went on at that school. If you walked through there, the air went out of my lungs just walking through there thinking, oh my God, there were so many children here. They were protected as best they could be, but you know, you can make the case that they should have had something better.
And I also read, John, where there's no regulations demanding that new homes have any kind of underground shelter either. And I suppose, okay, it's your own home, your king is your castle, but I mean, Massachusetts here, you know, Jim Brady wants to prevent people from smoking in the car with their kids in the back seat. And out in Oklahoma, you can build homes, you know, for your families, two kids, four kids, six kids, whatever it is, and no shelter for them. But that's perfectly legal there.
The mayor of Moore said that he wanted to propose that, and the question was, could he get enough votes on the town council to get it through? And again, you see some homes, you know, some of them have the most popular ones, when they build the home, they put them in the garage, and essentially it's a sliding door. You know when you go to the Jiffy Lube, you get your oil change,
yes,
pull it on top, and then the guy's underneath you in this,
yep,
little bay? It's like that, and then it's got a sliding bay over it. And it's, you know, you drop down, and it's only 4 or 5 feet, but you can get in there and crouch down and bury. I met a family, who they were coming, the morning after they went back to their home to see what they could find. They were mainly looking for their dogs. They had two dogs that they left behind, and they found one of them alive. But eight of them, from the grandmother to a two-month-old grandchild, got in this little basement. They lost their house, what they call May 3rd. That was the 1999 tornado that took pretty much the same path.
Yep.
In Moore now, they say May 3rd and May 20th. May 20th, obviously, was the recent one. And eight of them went down into this little storm shelter. And it started to take in water as the tornado was passing through. And the house collapsed on top of them. And they were there for an hour or two. And they said they finally heard people kicking around in the rubble, and they started screaming. And the first responders finally dug them out. The house had literally collapsed on top of this thing. But they lived because of it, and there was a bit of a panic when the water started coming, especially among the children. But they got out alive, and that woman credited that storm shelter.
We're talking to John King from CNN, who, as you know, spent a few days in Moore, Oklahoma. Hey, John, from the human to the political, my understanding is both United States senators from Oklahoma voted against increased funding for FEMA, Federal Emergency Management, and voted to reduce funding for the victims of Hurricane Sandy. How is that playing? I assume Oklahoma wants federal dollars, do they not?
They do, and they will get them. And you have had all of the Republicans quite complimentary. One of the interesting subplots here, and you see this with President Obama going up to see Governor Christie again in New Jersey, is you have Republican governors, Mary Fallon in Oklahoma, Chris Christie in New Jersey. We've had some others saying very nice things about the Obama White House and particularly about FEMA, which, if we go back to the Katrina days, we know was not exactly the best-run operation or the quickest operation. But Senator Inhofe and Senator Coburn are both fiscal conservatives, and Senator Coburn himself said on this trip, his first trip down there, he thinks FEMA has enough money, and that for some reason it doesn't have enough money because of disasters, and that if it's going to get more, and he's consistent on this, you can agree or disagree with this position, but at least he's consistent. He said if we have to give more money to FEMA, we have to find somewhere else to cut it. We're not going to deficit spend.
He's saying that even about federal money for Oklahoma? You're talking about current events, he's saying that?
Yes, he is.
Well, good for him.
If he says if for some reason the FEMA budget runs out and we need more, and he says, you know, the people of his state should be able to get what anyone else should get, whatever federal programs are available. But if you need more money, we got to find it elsewhere in the budget. And again, you know, a lot of people will gasp at that maybe, but he's consistent and he wins in his state. I mean, this is where, you know, you got to remember he's elected by the people of Oklahoma. And he also, Coburn has gone outside the box. Remember, he is the one. Inhofe is more conservative. Coburn is one of the guys who has said when they tried to bring up a grand bargain from time to time, that he doesn't want new taxes, but he's not going to say absolutely not, because you have to start the conversation. But he's an interesting guy, and he is consistent on this point that if we need more money, we got to find somewhere else to cut it.
You know, you have a better sense of presidential history than I think Marjorie and I do, John. But so Barack Obama was here, obviously, after the marathon. Then he was in Oklahoma a couple of days ago. As you say, he's making his second trip, at least his second trip, to New Jersey today with Governor Christie. This consoler-in-chief thing, is it just us, or is this the most frequently – is this the most we've ever seen a president have to do this kind of thing?
In such short order, absolutely. I mean, I think Bill Clinton, I remember, had several of these. Columbine was the one that got the most attention. George W. Bush had 9/11 and the, you know, things around that, and then had Katrina and some other disasters happen. In terms of, you know, Newtown, Boston, Sandy, a couple of shootings, Aurora, now the tornado, I can't remember them coming, you know, in succession like this and so closely together. And that is part of being president, especially in the modern presidency and the, you know, the communications age we live in. And I think on that front, you know, again, the president tends to get high marks personally for how he handles these things and how he meets with the families. And any president has to do that. They're, you know, and if you think about this, you know, he's a Democrat who went to West Texas and then he went to Oklahoma, and those are not his places politically, if you will, but good for him for going and taking the time to meet with those families. The trip back to New Jersey today, I think, is interesting. It's a tad more political in the sense that both Chris Christie and President Obama benefit from this at a time when each of them have, you know, some issues before them. Christie has some longer term questions, I think, politically. But in terms of the consoler in chief role, I've never seen a president who, you know, almost on a monthly basis of late, seems to be doing something like that.
Yeah,
you know,
I wonder if any of this takes away the Oklahoma situation. I mean, we haven't heard much about the IRS scandal, the Associated Press getting their phone records taken, Benghazi and stuff. I assume this is a temporary lull, John.
Now, there are going to be hearings and investigations and a lot of reporting going into those things. I would argue, and some of this might sound silly to people, but in a second term, every day counts, especially in a second term up to that first midterm election, the six-year itch election, they call it, for, you know, a two-term president. And so I do think that any time they're not making progress on things the president wants to move along, he's losing a day. Today's interesting because he goes back up to see Chris Christie, and I think that, you know, you mentioned the IRS controversy. That's one of the things. Even Benghazi, to this president's critics, and there are some other people who say, you know, these guys don't know how to run the lemonade stand, if you will. I would agree or disagree with them. They're not the best managers of their government. They don't have their hands on all the levers. The trip to New Jersey today does allow the president to remind people FEMA is one of the things, as I said a moment ago, where he gets bipartisan praise. And a lot of that, I mean, the president's the president. He's ultimately, we blame him when things go wrong, so you have to give him credit when things go right. But Craig Fugate is the guy who runs FEMA. By all accounts, just people in Washington and people in these states when they need the help, just a smart guy, a good guy who gets it, who knows how to move quickly, who doesn't get in the way of these governors and these mayors, just says, what do you need? Where can I put it? They've gotten a lot of credit for that one. The interesting thing for Christie is, you know, everyone thinks he's favored to win re-election, and I think he is favored. And they don't think this Democrat's up to much, but smart for him politically in the short term, because the nation's most popular Democrat is coming to his state in an election year in New Jersey. They have the odd number election, remember, year. And you know, then people will say, but is he hurting himself for 2016? I think you got another example of Chris Christie thinking, you know what, this is who I am. The president helped me with Sandy. I hugged him then. I'm going to hug him again. And if I run in 2016, we'll see what happens.
So, John, have you ever seen an image, speaking of hugging each other, have you ever seen an image on a tarmac quite like the image of Chris Christie standing next to the stick figure like Barack Obama? Did that get any better or what?
Charlie Crist and Barack Obama sort of matched up physically, didn't they? Chris Christie's a little different kind of a guy.
I
find him fascinating.
His
calculation on 2016 is, if, you know, so there are some Republicans who are going to say, he hurt Mitt Romney, and now he's doing it again and hugging Barack Obama, who to some Republicans is, you know, the Antichrist.
Right.
Christie's calculation is, you know what, I'm not going to get their votes anyway. And number two, if a big part of the party feels that way again, if they're so visceral about just working with a guy, you know, trying to help your state, well, then we're going to lose anyway. And in some ways, you know, good for him.
I hope he doesn't forget and just bench press Obama. Last question for me,
John. Is he a Yankees fan or a Phillies fan?
I don't know. He's lost a lot of weight, though. He had that operation,
hey,
right?
John, last question. Immigration sort of got backburnered again because of the three controversies and then, or scandals, depending on your point of view. And then obviously the Oklahoma thing happened. It got four Republican votes in the committee. You have people like the Democratic Senator Menendez from Jersey saying we still don't have enough votes. I assume that's just sort of a warm-up act. What is the path for this thing? What's the likelihood? Is the House moving? Where are we?
If you want something big done, the fact that this one seems to sometimes fall into the back burner is actually a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's the pinata of the day, it's so emotional, it gets everybody riled up. The more on this that is done, I'm not saying privately, I believe what you had in the committee was that's the way it's supposed to work. You know, they had 300 amendments filed. They had to take public votes up and down on the amendments. They had to debate them. Now they're going to do that on the Senate floor. That's what Senator Menendez is talking about. And so the Republicans who didn't, the conservatives who didn't get a shot at it in committee, who want to change it, and the liberals who want to change some things as well, will get a chance on the Senate floor. That's the way it's actually supposed to work. We elect people. We send them to Washington. They're supposed to debate in public. Then they're supposed to vote. Let the chips fall where they may. The interesting part to me in the House is I went up to talk to a bunch of the chairmen, the House chairmen who are investigating Benghazi. And one of them is Bob Goodlatte, who runs the Judiciary Committee, which also will get right. immigration. Now, he's a guy who used to call any path to citizenship amnesty. He says he's open to it, not the way the president wants it, not even the way Marco Rubio wants it. He says Marco Rubio goes too far. But Bob Goodlatte looked me in the eye, and he said he was not going to let the IRS or Benghazi or anything else get in the way. He wasn't going to let people use it as an excuse to, quote-unquote, not give the president something he wants. And I think a lot of Republicans feel that way, and I was convinced after that conversation that he's going to try to get a bill through the House Judiciary Committee. We've talked about this before. Can he get a path to citizenship through that committee? I don't know. He doesn't know.
But do you subscribe to this notion that if they get a number higher than a filibuster buster, let's say 63, 64, 65 votes, that allegedly sends a powerful message to House Republicans that they have to do that? I never quite understood that equation. Do you buy
it
that?
It does. It does. I'm not saying it sends a you must do this, but it sends a you'll have cover. Many of you House members
cover,
will
okay.
be. Yeah, many of you Republican House members will be from the same states as those Republican senators who just cast this vote. So you won't be going home alone, and you'll have more company out there defending it. Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, some of the darlings of the conservative movement. If they're for the Senate bill and it gets a big vote, it gives the Congressman X from somewhere more cover. And those guys, Rubio and those guys have said, I'll go home with you. If you have a tough bill, if you work with me on this and you're having a tough race, I'll go help you raise money. So it'll be – watching the Republican dynamics will be fascinating on this. I'm not sure you can get as big as I'm going to use the word liberal. I'm not sure it's the right word. But as liberal a path to citizenship out of the House, I know you can't, than you can out of the Senate. The question is, can they get a path to citizenship in a bill out of the House? And then what happens when they go back and try to put the two of them back together? Because the president is on the record saying he will not accept anything short of a path to citizenship. The House could pass a bill giving you a path to legal status if you're here illegally now, but never a path to citizenship.
Which is what Obama did with the Dream Act, is it not? Isn't
right.
legal status what he ultimately ended up with there?
That's what he took in the compromise.
Yeah.
But so there's a long way to go on this, and everybody's red line today, may move tomorrow. But they actually are making slow progress, and I think the fact that it's slow. And that they're actually debating it in public, and it's not like so many of these bills, you put 1,500 pages right. together or 2,000 pages together, and you do that at 8 o'clock at night, and then at 10 o'clock the next morning you're voting on the floor. That angers people, and especially angers the people who can block this, the Tea Party, the conservative base of the Republican Party. They have a right to say, let's have a transparent process. The question is, if they get one and they're losing, are they then going to demand filibusters and, throwing every parliamentary roadblock in the way?
You think they're angry. They're not as angry as I am when you asked me if I was rooting for the Phillies or the Red Sox. Trust me. Hey, John King, great reporting from Oklahoma.
Good to talk to you. All politics is local.
It is. Talk to you next Tuesday, John. Thanks.
John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. As Jim just said, he's with us every Tuesday at noon. Okay. Scientific research shows that people are ruder, angrier, and more unreasonable when they are online than they are in real life. Now there's anecdotal evidence that this is playing out on the comment thread surrounding Marinino's prostate surgery. Crossing the Line Online is next on Boston Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. On Friday, this past Friday, Emily Rooney joined us on Open Mic. And one of the things we talked about were the horrible comments posted by some people on stories and columns in the newspaper. There was unanimity on Friday, unanimity of disgust, I guess I should say, which came into play again this morning, as Marjorie just said, when you're reading the comments in both Boston newspapers about Tom Menino's prostate surgery, because she couldn't wait till Friday. Rejoining us again is Emily Rooney. Were these unbelievable? Can I read a few, by the way?
Give us some samples. Yeah, we need some samples. Yeah. Go ahead.
You do it. Take it away.
Here's one.
What paper is this?
This is the Boston Herald.
Go ahead.
I think you took my copy of the Boston Globe, but they're just as bad.
Go ahead.
And half of them are redacted off the Boston Globe. Right, here's
fully
one.
Half of them. Yeah, the first 20, of 11 of them were
right,
taken
here's
out.
One from Mandarin. And these are all bogus names. That's the other thing. People should have to use their name. Am I right, Marjorie? Here's Mandarin.
Well, they won't comment if they have to use their name.
Another Democratic lifelong hack and thief. May the worst visit him as he deserves. That is just
horrible.
And this guy's, what proof does this guy have that Mayor Menino's a thief? May the worst visit him?
Well, it gets worse. It's also more insulting. I'm only reading these. These are public, so you can go check them out yourself. This is also from the Herald. From Ocean City, Mumbles would be wise to mark his butt before surgery. The doctors could make a mistake and remove his enlarged tongue. And by the way, those are not aberrationally bad. They are appalling. And we want to ask you at 877-301-8970 a couple things. If you're a commenter on stories, why do you do it? Particularly if you do this negative kind of thing. And two, do you subscribe to the notion the three of us bought into on Friday is the way to eradicate this thing is what Dan Kennedy does on his blog, which is make you say your whole, full, real name, in which case most of these basement dwellers would not be posting these things. You know, I woke up, I told you, at 5:30 this morning. I'm reading the story in the Herald about Menino's prostate surgery because I hadn't heard last night that it wasn't cancerous, and I wanted to read to make sure it wasn't, and it wasn't. 10 of the first 11. These aren't the outliers. 10 of the first 11 were more insulting than the ones before.
But they're insulting in the Globe, too.
I mean,
they have one, recover quickly. Boston still needs all of what you do best, Mr. Mayor. The next commenter, all of what you do best? What? Mumble? And that's one of the nicer ones because they're making a joke.
Also,
they're talking about how he should get his ducks in order and make his will and everything else.
Yeah, one was suggesting that this is bad news for you, Mr. Mayor, and you should get your
ducks in order. Yeah, make out your will and get your ducks in order. That's from the Globe. The man upstairs is telling you something and it isn't good.
You have to repeat if you're reading the Globe that they eliminated close to 50% of these. So the ones you are reading are the least offensive of the ones. Right.
The first 20 comments, 11 of them. So out of 30, a third of them were removed.
Can I tell you
something? This one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Happy Humpty Mumbles is constantly falling and can't get up. The city runs itself. He's a figurehead who cuts ribbons and visits schools, urging kids to do well, or they will end up like him, illiterate and overweight.
But one of the issues I think for us, and again, our number is 877-301-8970. If you're a poster, if you're a consumer of these comments, tell us why you do either. And I wanted to ask you: all three of us are contemptuous of most of these comments.
Yeah.
Why do we read them? I mean, I understand reading the underlying story. I have to say there's almost nothing that I read where I don't immediately go
to
the comments.
Usually.
Well, I do.
Okay, I usually don't. And what got me going, Marjorie, was last Friday, you had done a story on that guy who was being sentenced 30 years later.
Irving, the rapist.
Oh, yes, that raped three teenage girls.
It was my shortcoming. I was kind of not up to speed on that story, and I wanted to... What was this all about? So I started reading the Globe version, which was the actual sentencing that day, and could not. And then I was on the Globe page and I scrolled down to the comments, and the comments were not directed at him, but rather the three young girls. They were young girls when they were
teenagers.
Raped. And, you know, let this guy go. He's served enough. He spent 30 years in Maine. That should be enough. And then some of it got, you know, really vile, directed at the three people who reported him. I mean, you know. Talk about warped and
But here's the problem. I think that everybody wants to draw traffic to their websites. A lot of my friends have said to me, you know, Marjorie, I don't read your stories, but I read the comments on your stories saying how much they all hate you. You know, I said, thank you very much. But it does drive traffic. I mean, you just said it, Jim. The comments to you are more fun than the story itself. So
did I say more fun?
Well, I think you sort
I
of
probably did.
And I think that's one of the problems. People get drawn to this nasty stuff.
Well,
and they kind of revel in it.
Back in the day when there was only email, and that was the only way to sort of correspond with all of us in the TV business anyway, I'd say 90% of the comments that we got were about something I was wearing, you know, my legs, something, the hairdo, some where'd you get that jacket, you know, that kind
of
thing.
I sent one of the hairdo ones. I was under an assumed name.
So it's very rarely that, you know, even, you know, people who were using their real names, by the way, in emails were commenting on anything that was kind of a substantive nature. So I think it's kind of – and by the way, people don't comment to say something positive for the most part. Think about that.
No, they don't. But that, but I have to say, back in the dark ages when we just got phone calls, most of the phone calls I got were complaints.
They were.
I mean, it was rare that someone would call you and say, gee, that was a good story, or gee, actually, I shouldn't say that. Oftentimes, if it's a sad story about someone needing help, you will get a lot of calls from people saying, how can I help that person? Where can I send the check? So it's not always true. But
so what do you think what motivates someone? You know, by the way, if you were critical and funny, I'm sort of willing to give you a pass. I mean, maybe even more than a pass. But most of these are not even funny.
They're just stupid
and cruel and low rent. And I don't understand. When you sit at the computer deciding to do this, what are you – because you're unhappy in your life? Because you want to vent against the writer?
Truth to power, Jim.
You don't like the property taxes? But if you want to speak truth to power, you can write a letter to the editor, by the way.
But then you have to sign your name and put your address and your phone number. And they call you up
and
verify.
That's what I want people to do. I want the phone number.
You are who you say you are. I think the problem is that, like I said, people want traffic on their websites. This gets traffic on the websites. It gives an interactive – and you know something, frankly – I never read the comments on my stories because it's an exercise in masochism.
And I call her at 6 o'clock in the morning.
You're the worst columnist in America. You don't know how to do anything. You're a jerk. I mean, there's no point in reading those.
You know, for those who haven't heard us mention this before, and then we'll get to the calls at 877-301-8970. Again, particularly if you're one of these people who post these angry comments, sort of man or woman up and give us a – well, they may. It's anonymous here too. The most extreme example of this – I've mentioned this on the air before – Marjorie, a couple of Christmases ago, at the time of Marley and Me, writes a story about her relationship her 10-pound dog.
Harry the P.
The front page
best
of the Herald.
Dog from C2C.
It's not a photograph of somebody with an EBT card running down the street. It's a picture of Marjorie holding her fluffy little dog.
No, it wasn't even me. It was just the dog.
It was just the dog.
I wasn't even in there.
I read the comments on this thing.
Really?
I am telling you, it is as if she were Hannibal Lecter.
What was the issue?
Everyone, what kind of relationship does that
– I was having sex with my dog.
Exactly. Some people were suggesting, and she's a shrew, and the only person who will talk to her, the only thing that will talk to her is her
dog. Yeah.
It was, and they weren't funny either. Even well, a couple of them were funny.
You read them for 4 days.
I memorized most. Well, because there were hundreds of them. That's why. 877-301-8970. You know what I haven't read yet? I just realized. Is there's nothing in your paper that provokes comments like Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth Warren.
You wrote a piece about her college loan thing. Have you read those yet today?
I'm sure
they're
just
imagine.
Despicable.
Let's try
hate
some
me,
phone calls.
Hate her. Hate everything.
Nick, you're in Salem, Massachusetts, and you're on with Emily Rooney, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Nick. Thanks for the call.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent.
All right. So what I'm hearing is that the problem is the commentary shouldn't be – you don't want to see the commentary. Just correct me if I'm – mistaken. You don't
well,
want to see
I,
that?
I don't mind no. it because, like I said, it drives traffic to the website. So I've become inured.
Well, you don't read it. So,
I don't read
mean,
it.
Of course
no, no.
you don't.
First of all, he doesn't have this right. This is vile, inaccurate, disgusting untruths that they're saying about Mayor Menino. It's just there's no proof. You know, the only surgery this walrus should have is getting his mouth wired shut. What
it's
is
like
that?
Gratuitous unkindness.
What is that?
Go ahead. You think this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, someone.
Well, someone thinks it obviously. Yeah.
So,
so what?
So the problem to me is that these comments should be available, because if you want to change these kinds of attitudes, you need to understand where people are coming from to understand why they're coming
well,
from.
Well, then, Nick, if that's the case, how about the Emily Rooney, Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan's Dan Kennedy solution?
Yeah,
if
I'll
they
get wanna, back to you.
If they want to get their thoughts out to the public, then they sign them. They say, Nick so-and-so from Salem, Massachusetts. How about that? No anonymity.
Well, I think that more than anything would just cause more people to find those people and then, you know, attack their social outlets, their Facebook and things like that.
Well, if you don't have it in you to be willing to take what you give, then yeah, that's a great question, Nick. How about that?
When I was younger, I was a big time commenter.
Why'd you do it?
Because I had very strong opinions and I thought that people were saying seeing silly things on the internet, especially, and I wanted to try to give my two cents. And I stopped because, ultimately, online, it's a very terrible place to try and express yourself and to have a serious debate, especially because the time that you're saying it is not the time that the person's seeing it. And, you know, the conversation is over the span of too much time to be able to be on the same page.
Nick, did you write a positive comment when you were a commenter?
I would write positive comments whenever I had a positive opinion.
Okay, well, you're sort of passed the test. Nick, thank you for the call.
You know what my favorite thing is? When the commenters get into fight with each other.
Yeah. I love those.
Calling each other's names.
Yeah, they go back and forth. And they're fighting. Yeah. That's really great. I love that. Sheila from Norton. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
My comment would be, I think when Emily was repeating some of the comments about Mayor Menino being mumbles, et cetera, I think all of those comments may very well be in Howie Carr's articles. And in one sense, I think that's sort of, at least he put his name on it, I suppose.
I think he did come up with the nickname Mumbles. I think we can give credit to Howie Carr for that.
I think he fosters, if you listen to his radio station at all, or only the column.
Yeah, but Sheila, you know, can I tell you something? You may not like this, but as an extension of what we're talking about, if you have the courage and you're a columnist or a commenter, again, to sign your name to something, there's very little that I'm not willing to tolerate. That's your point of view. You own it. People can get to respond to it. So even if you're unhappy with the content of what Howie writes, you're okay with that, right?
Yeah, you know what? I agree. At least he puts his name on it.
Yeah, well.
I was going to say that someone has taken action. The Twitter account of, I guess, Howard Stern has been filled with hate, and he actually has hired an investigator to look into the main people who have sort of bombarded his Twitter and looking into seeing exactly who they are.
Talk about the pot and the kettle. Oh, my good Lord.
Yeah.
Isn't that what he does
Sheila,
for a living?
For the call.
He says horrible things about people for a living.
Yeah, but what's good for the goose, you know, is never...
You know,
by the way,
speaking
of this, can we play this great thing? There's a great bite. On SNL, Saturday Night Live, there was a skit with Melissa McCarthy. It was called Internet Comments Talk Show, and it perfectly captures the essence of this. Listen to this.
Under a video of a bear falling out of a tree onto a trampoline, you wrote, "Obama is our first Nigerian president."
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I'm a lawyer by day, and I feel very constricted at work. And the comment section is a nice outlet for my emotions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. And are you really a lawyer?
No, I am not.
Nothing is true in these things. No. I mean, nothing is true. Okay, let's continue. Let's go to Alyssa. She's in Worcester. She's on with Emily, Jim, and Marjorie. Hey there, Alyssa.
Hi, how are you guys?
Excellent, thanks.
Good, I love your show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to say a few years ago, my family, the Telegram and Gazette, came to interview my brother and I about college. We're both in college. I'm in grad school. And just to interview us about how we were able to afford college, loans, scholarships, et cetera. And it was posted online, and people were leaving comments that were really hateful, like, oh, well, you guys are spoiled. You know, your parents got you through college. They took care of you. I worked my way through school, and the way you're doing it is wrong. And that's not how I feel at all. And I felt it was unfair for them to say those things because things weren't the way that they were maybe 20 years ago where you could put yourself through school. So I was really surprised that people left so many comments, and they didn't even know us. They didn't know the full story. Just completely unprovoked.
Alyssa, you know, I've had to warn people, especially if I'm doing a sad story. I mean, D.J. Henry's a classic case, a young man who was killed allegedly by a police officer.
Well, he was killed by a police officer. The question is whether there's
intentionally
criminal
liability.
And he's dead. A wonderful young man. He's dead. And I wrote a story interviewing his family about the loss of their kid. Their kid is dead. You would not believe how vicious the attacks were against the family, against the young man who's dead. The mother called me up practically in tears.
Really?
And I said, don't even pay attention. This is what they always do. Don't take it personally. It's not about you. But that's what it's like. It's like this venting that's really got nothing to do with you or with DJ Henry or with my dog. It's just sort of this crazy stuff.
I mean,
that's all I can think of. It's just venting.
Yeah.
Hey, Alyssa, thank you. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sure. Have a good day, guys.
You too. Thanks for sharing your story.
You feel like you're opening up these poor people that you're interviewing now to this kind of venom, and you have to warn them in advance.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think of that.
Really,
you sort of do. You have to let them know that, by the way, once you see my column, and you start reading it and you go down to the comments, it's not going to be good. You're not going to like it.
Well, I've told people not to read the comments, but of course that makes
them
read the comments.
They do, yeah.
And then they
so
can't
saying,
believe
can we go
it.
Back to what you said before? The comments are in – when did they start? Well, like 6, 7, 8 years ago, something like that?
I don't know.
And so that is purely because it draws more people in, right? Because we like to read them and it's going to – that's what it's about.
The whole idea was to make – because newspapers are failing so desperately – to make it interactive.
Interactive, right.
And draw it to the – and then you start looking at the ads that are next to the comments and all that. So, yeah.
We just got a nice email from Tom from Lowell who says he uses his real name and he usually complains a lot. When he's really complaining, he uses the name Jim Browdy.
By the way, there is on the Herald. I forgot this. There is a Herald poster who uses my name.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just.
There you go.
Whatever.
One of these guys has his real name. This guy, Scott Harley. I already read his email.
What did he say? It was ugly?
Yeah.
Well, it didn't stop him, did it?
Yeah.
Well, I guess, but if he does it and he attaches it to him.
It might be his neighbor's name.
But it could be somebody else, exactly.
That's a great point.
I finally posted something on my Facebook page, put my picture on my Facebook page, and then I looked down on the postings. And I was talking about porn tapes. I thought, I was never talking about porn tapes.
Can I tell you, I used your name, actually, instance.
I have no idea.
Well, you know what
I don't post anything.
You know, there's so much. I hope I get this right. And one of our colleagues in the control room will tell me if I'm wrong. If you go to someone's Twitter page and there's a little check in a blue circle, you know what that is? They have been certified as the real version of that person. So when your profile gets a little high, to ensure that it's not somebody else using your name to say something that's going to destroy your life and your career, somebody at Twitter certifies that you are
that's
the real Marjorie
Egan. Please stop putting porn tape references on my Facebook
page. I did it one time. It's not the end of it. Bob, you're on I-95. We're talking about these appalling comments attached to the Menino prostate surgery stories. Hi, Rob. Bob, sorry.
Hi. Just three comments. I think it's the media, it's technology that enable this kind of behavior by allowing anonymous posting and allowing fringe people, and I think there's just a handful of them, to reach the general public. And thirdly, with regard to Howie Carr, I think he lowers the bar.
But we don't need to have it. The purpose of today was not to do a Howie Carr criticism.
No, but let me just finish this. I respect both of you, but you rally around anytime we have criticism of the press.
No, excuse me. No. First of all, it's not true. My view is if you want to criticize somebody, not you, if one wants to criticize somebody, then they should be invited in to be part of the defense of their position. And since he's not here, I just don't think it's right. So I hear your point, but respectfully, we're not going to be doing that. So what was your point? What was the first point you made about the media? You say it's the media. What's the media doing about it?
Let me just say this without referring to any particular reporter.
Okay, fine.
Reporters who engage in the kind of name-calling that we occasionally find in the print journals, but also, I think, more commonly on the radio, are enabling this kind of cheap shot stuff and lowering the bar on civility. And I think it's the wrong direction.
Well,
I think there's some truth to that.
I do, too. But the answer is don't listen to that station and don't read that column, I guess.
But, you know, the worst example I ever saw was in a Globe story, and this was a horrific case where a mentally disturbed aunt took her sister's two children,
stripped them and walked
them across.
The road,
I think it was 128
the Merritt Parkway, or something,
and they were all killed.
Yeah.
And I mean, just a horrible tragedy. And commenters were attacking the mother who lost both her children for saying, "How could you let your sister take those kids? How could you be so irresponsible? Yeah. What a bad mother you are!" This was her sister who had a mental health issue in the past, had gotten better supposedly. Obviously, she wasn't better. I thought, who attacks a mother who just lost her children? But it's the same thing with D.J. Henry attacking her who lost her son.
There's
no bar too low.
You know, Bob made an interesting point, which I hadn't thought about before. Bob, the caller from a second ago. Is it possible that there is a small cadre of newspaper posters?
Yeah.
I don't know how many it is, but,
probably.
You know, 20, 30, whatever it is. But they get a great audience because how many thousands, tens of thousands of people go to BostonHerald.com, Boston.com, BostonGlobe.com, and that essentially they get this huge platform. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be really interesting, which we haven't done. Maybe you could do, too, as part of your Beat the Press thing. See how – and obviously they can change their screen name.
Yeah, that's
See how
thing.
Often – Jane Doe or John, whatever this reappears.
That's the thing, though. They can change it every time.
They can. But why would they need, if it's anonymous, why do they need to change it? Just sort of an interesting thing. Let's take one more if we can. Let's go to John. You're in Belmont. You're on with Emily, Jim, and Marjorie. Roll a poll, John. Go ahead. It's a joint appellation, if that's a word. Hi, John. Hi, John.
Oh, we lost John.
Thank you. Let's end with Maureen from Dedham. Maureen, you are next with the three of us. Hey.
Oh, hi. Maureen from Dedham.
Hi.
Oh, hi, Jim and Marjorie and Emily. I love all three of you.
Thank you kindly. Good.
Yeah, first time I ever called a radio station.
Oh, my goodness.
But I feel so strongly. I was driving home from shopping, and I heard about Mayor Menino being so disrespected. I did not read it.
Good.
I tend not to. I think I'm like Marjorie. If it starts to be negative, I don't give those people attention.
Good for you, Maureen.
Yeah, you know, I just think it's indicative of a society. I'm 49, and I guess I'm going to sound like an old lady here, but I think it's so indicative of a society where we don't have respect. We just, in general, do not have respect for each other, for elders, for others. And it's disgusting. I mean, I just can't imagine how they would call Mayor Menino. Even if I didn't like him, I just would be offended by what I heard you guys reading.
Well, yeah, and you, as we say, you can imagine the ones that were excised from the Globe may have even been worse. Maureen, you're talking about the death of civility, and I agree with you. It's just an egregious example of it, and your first phone call was excellent, Maureen. Do it again. Thanks so much.
Isn't that, what is that great word, schadenfreude, though?
Yeah, schadenfreude.
Kind of like, oh, yeah. You know, you relish in other people's agony
misery.
And misery. So there's some of that here, too. I mean, you got to picture, you say, you know, basement dwellers, you got to picture all of these people. You know, they're nobodies. You know, they don't have a decent job. They resent everybody who has anything, a nice car, a good job, you know, nice children. I mean, that's how I picture all of these people.
What if we found out they're all city councilors in Boston? Would that be
all going to be, one of them's going to be the next mayor.
Exactly. Emily Rooney was a joy.
Thank you guys.
Thanks for stopping
Thank you
by.
Very much. Emily comes in every Friday, 2 at 1, with her list of complaints.
I already have great stuff on my list. I'm going to love it. Love
it's only Tuesday.
Yeah, talk about venting. I think we're restoring a wonderful service here. Okay. Over the weekend, 17 teenagers in Hingham were arrested for underage drinking at a house party. And this happened while the homeowner, one of the teens' fathers, was there. Joining us to sort through those details is Erin Smith from the Boston Herald. She'll be with us in just a couple of seconds. WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Reporting a rape in Pakistan can lead to more punishment for the victim than for the accused.
She's an outcast. She will never get married. She's destined to be killed by someone from her own family because she's impure now.
But one young woman is speaking up anyway, all the way to the high court. We'll talk with the filmmakers of Outlawed in Pakistan. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you and Boston Private Bank, helping business owners, entrepreneurs, nonprofits, and families manage their banking and investment needs. This is your time. This is your private bank. Boston Private Bank. BostonPrivateBank.com. And Constitution USA. Peter Sagal travels across America to see how the Constitution has united us as a nation and how it has nearly pulled us apart. Constitution USA concludes Tuesday at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A couple of times a year, we read the exact same story, just different parents, different kids, same results. Lots of underage drinking, a parent or two in trouble, and a ton of questions about what mothers and fathers should allow their kids and their friends to do in their house and when the law should get involved. Great story today out of Hingham, beautifully written by Erin Smith in the Herald. I love the title. Love the word verb nabbed in a headline. 18 nabbed at Hingham Bash. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Erin Smith. Hi, Erin.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey, thanks for joining us, Erin. So what the heck happened down there in Hingham involving, as you put it, 17 sloshed teens and a plastered parent. What happened, Erin?
Well, the Hingham police said they got a call from neighbors that there was this rowdy party going on there. And when they showed up, they arrested about, 16 underage or minors between the ages of 17 and 20. Another 21-year-old man from Hull and one of the actual homeowner whose son was also arrested as well.
He was the one that was plastered, the homeowner, allegedly plastered, according to the cops, right?
Yeah, they found him after they had arrested all of the youths, and they found him in the barn, you know, cleaning up the beer cans and the cups. And he, you know, according to police reports, appeared unsteady on his feet, glassy-eyed. So they said he appeared drunk.
And you had a great detail about what happened to the first police officer who shows up on the scene. What happened?
Well, the police tell me that a beer bottle, a glass beer bottle, was thrown right at his head.
Oh, great.
As they realized that the police had showed up, some of the youths started throwing beer bottles, so he ducked back into his cruiser. Another one hit the hood of his cruiser. So he just stayed there until backup arrived. All told, I guess 15 officers it took to get the situation under control.
Yeah, I think it's always a good idea when the cops show up at your house to throw a beer bottle at the head of the cop who responds.
Hey, Aaron Smith, the father, whomever he is, the 51-year-old who was arrested in the barn, he's charged with a violation of the social host law that we've had in Massachusetts for the last decade or so. That's one of the charges, right?
Well, police said they're filing today a criminal complaint against him. He wasn't actually arrested. It's on three charges, actually. One is the social host law, which is allowing, you know, minors to have alcohol at your house, and then disturbing the peace and being a keeper of a noisy and disorderly house.
And, you know, the police use discretion in these cases. While we read about them every two or three months, one of these horror shows, they don't arrest all the time. I mean, it's got to be a certain level of egregiousness, does it not, for the cops to decide, here's a situation where people should be criminally charged. Am I not right about that?
Well, in this situation, it took officers from three cities and towns, Hingham, Cohasset, and Weymouth. So it took considerable time to get under control. It was close to midnight when the first officer showed up. And apparently there was just beer bottles and cans and cups everywhere, and that when they did show up, the youths fled into the barn, the woods, and some of them jumped into their car, and they were stopped before they were able to drive away.
Here's the thing, Jim.
Yeah, Jim.
I forgot your name momentarily.
Okay,
sorry about that. It was one cop per every sloshed team.
No, that's true, by the way. I was going to say that next. It is unbelievable.
Took a lot to get things under control down there.
Hey, Erin, you end your story by saying efforts to reach hacking. That's the 51-year-old for comment at his home. Yes, they're unsuccessful. A reporter was asked to leave the property. Who asked you to leave the property? Do you know?
There was a woman. It appeared the whole family was there gathered in the backyard, and it appeared like a woman who was a member of the family asked me to leave the property. I barely got out the name of my newspaper before, you know, I was asked to leave.
Yeah.
But we go to those, you know, those lengths when we do put somebody in the paper to give them a chance
sure.
to comment.
And last thing for me, Aaron Smith, is and everybody, all these charges are going to be heard, at least the arraignment is on all these charges is today. Is that correct in Hingham District Court or
that's,
something?
That's correct.
Great. Aaron, great story.
Great
and
story.
Thank you.
And I think one of the great all-time leads on a story I've ever
read,
Aaron. It was wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. Aaron Smith from the Boston Herald.
Hey, Aaron, thank you. Our number is 877-301-8970. Because there was not an unhappy ending here, Marjorie and I are each laughing, but a lot of these stories, you guys know this, a lot of these stories have really horrible endings. There's no evidence at all in this case that this hacking guy, that's the name of the owner of the house, the 51-year-old, even took the keys of these underage people, which means they could have driven somewhere drunk as they did in that case. But let me just read you the first paragraph we're both commenting on, which is sort of the perfect tabloid opening to a story. Drunken underage revelers threw glass bottles at an officer's heads as cops tried to break up a holiday weekend beer bash in Hingham that netted 17 sloshed revelers and a plastered parent who cops later found cleaning up beer cans in a backyard barn, police said. Our number is 877-301-8970. The serious side of this,
oh, God.
Is it ever a good idea to let underage kids drink in your house? And what do you think about enforcing? My view is this social host law, enforce it wherever you can. You know what the impact is? It sends a warning shot across the proverbial bowels of other parents. My attitude is this about this thing, Marjorie. If your kid is there and there are a couple other friends and you're friendly with the parents and the parents of those other kids say it's fine for little Johnny to drink at your house as long as you take the keys, as long as there are only two or three, it's fine. There is never a circumstance, and I hate to be a purist about this, there is never a circumstance where you should take responsibility for other people's teenage kids drinking and potentially driving, or maybe not even driving, having something horrible happen to them in your house. It is totally mm-hmm. indefensible. And my view, you're smirking at me, view is prosecute these adults. Forget the kids for the moment, unless they cause damage. I mean, the one who threw a bottle at a police officer's head should probably be prosecuted. Short of that, the reality is make them do community service. business or something, but set an example with his father so there are other how about the story last year you and I did at our former radio station where the couple was upstairs and said they didn't hear. How many people were there? 30 people in the basement?
I told
hundreds
you,
of beer cans?
You did not believe me when I told you that a friend of mine who is a former first assistant district attorney, you know, prosecutor, said the same thing happened to him and his wife. They were sleeping upstairs. They had about 20 kids in the basement partying. They had no idea. I don't think it's that hard to have it happen. You know, you're falling asleep at 10 o'clock. The kids are partying at midnight. I live in fear as a mother of three that I'll be arrested for running a disorderly house. You know, Marjorie Egan allegedly ran a disorderly house. I mean, how does that sound? Like you failed completely and totally. I mean, I am paranoid about this. I wouldn't let
anybody's
kid.
Well, by the way, they don't charge. You know, our colleague, Edgar B. Herrick III, did a little research on the social hosting law. And this is pretty obvious. The state law, which was passed, I think, in 2000, says the word furnish, meaning furnish alcohol to someone under 21 years, you have to knowingly or intentionally supply, give, or provide. So the police aren't arresting these people if they think they're just innocent bystanders. They have to be somewhat
an active participant
in the thing, which is dangerous.
And your husband or your wife go out for dinner and there are 30 kids back at your house getting sauced and the neighbors call the cop. That is when you'll be arrested, Jim, for running. Well, you might not be arrested. You'll be charged with running a disorderly house. You're keeping a disorderly house in the neighborhood. It's very humiliating.
It's interesting. You know a lot about this.
I do.
Apparently. 877-301-8970. If you've had experiences in situations like this, how do you deal with it? You know, you raise an interesting question, by the way. Let's assume you get home. There really is an innocent parent. You get home and you have 20 drunk teenagers in your house. I assume the right thing to do is you have somebody take away the alcohol and you call their parents. Isn't that what you do?
Yeah, you'd sit there and call the parents.
That's
20
what you do,
kids.
Right.
That's right. Or, I mean, you could turn them in, which you probably don't want to do.
Do you remember?
Maybe you do want
to
do.
One more story, and then we'll get to the Coles. Do you remember another place? This man, was it Wellesley? I'm not sure. Where kids got drunk in this house. I believe the parents were legitimately away here. Mm-hmm. They totally destroyed the place. The way they identified, the police identified the kids, and correct me if I'm wrong, is because they were also drunk. They left their ID, their
this
backpack, their wallets. It was in Wellesley. And
the
most appalling part of that story.
The mother of the house, they were going away for vacation, and she asked the lovely child next door, I believe it was a boy, a teenager, can you feed the cats, keep an eye on the house while we're gone?
And he's what the one who had
do?
The party?
No sooner were they down the street, all bets were off. They were partying in there for 3 days. They had holes on the wall. They had all sorts of...
But what was the most significant part of that story, if I remember correctly, which speaks not just to the parent who owns the house where it happens, but to the parents of the revelers, is not one single parent called the parents whose house was destroyed.
You know why?
To either apologize, to offer them compensation, to make their kid go over there and say, we'll clean up the basement for you.
You know why they didn't do it?
Why?
Because they were afraid that they would lose their college admissions and or their scholarships to those colleges.
Yeah, well, I got news for you. If you're drunk and you're destroying someone's property, then you lose your scholarship.
Okay,
877-301-8970.
It's easy to say, what is somebody else's kid?
That's a very good
getting
point.
Getting $50,000
fine,
a year to go to the college of their choice.
Let's start in Plaistow, New Hampshire with Ellen. Ellen, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome and thanks for the call.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Yep.
Well, I had an experience over some years that I had a child that was going in the wrong direction of life, and I would leave my house searching for that child every single night. And I knew of two particular homes that my child was always in the basement snorting cocaine and drinking alcohol.
Oh,
that these families of age sons were supplying, buying the alcohol. But, you know, one of them was a small-time dealer of cocaine, and I used to show up. And, of course, the parents would lie to me and say that she wasn't in their basement. And there was really very little you could do. If I could have had them arrested, I would have had them arrested. It was almost impossible to do. And let me tell you, those kids that were supplying the cocaine and drinking alcohol didn't go to college, and neither did the child of mine who was going in the wrong direction head off for college.
Ellen.
They headed off for jail. And I'm telling you, it's the bad parents who don't care. You care about your kid, and you are going out, and you are dredging the streets looking for them, and you've got these parents who don't care about their kids, so why would they care about yours, letting your kid run amok in their basement?
That's an awful story, Ellen. Were they not caring because they were having the bag themselves?
No, it was more that they just They just didn't care. They just didn't care. They didn't see a future for their kids, so why would they see a future for yours? Well, sorry. Obviously, I care, or I would not be here looking.
Ellen, how's your kid now?
I'm in jail.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But my other child has done fabulously. He went to She went to private school all her life, too.
Yeah.
And my son did fabulously. The other one went fabulously, went down to St. John's Prep on almost a full scholarship, went to college on a full scholarship, is now getting a second degree, which he's paying for, which he should. And he did fabulously. But it's when you have a kid that you can tell wants to run wild and you're doing everything you can to keep them from doing that, as when they find those kids and those families that will help them run wild, they're often gone.
Ellen, thanks for the call.
Thank you for the call, and good luck to your child.
To you.
Yeah, that's not an easy one. 877-301-8970. Do you ever think it's okay to let kids, not your own kids, be drinking in your house?
Do you?
No, I don't.
Do you really feel that way, or are you just saying?
Listen, I am all for. I think we have gotten crazy about alcohol, and we're so paranoid about it. We don't teach kids to drink, and I certainly think
your own kids.
Yes, and I certainly think that the guy from Middlebury College,
Amethyst Initiative,
which is a great idea, which is what he said should happen in colleges, that 18-year-olds should be able to drink because
this is all, by the way, this guy from Middlebury got the signatures of, I think, hundreds of other college presidents on this.
He made a brilliant point. The way it is now, when you go to college and you're under age, you're not supposed to drink. So what these kids do is they binge drink and get sauce before they go to the dance, the concert, the whatever it is, because they can't drink like a normal person, you know, have a beer an hour or something in a reasonable way. They just shove the liquor in. Binge drinking has become an epidemic. He was right about it. But you know why they won't get rid of that law? It all has to do with funding. It's the same thing with Mothers Against Drunk Driving. It's funding for highway funds. There's a link between.
Yeah, but Congress could change that, obviously.
They could change it.
For those who don't know, you'd lose your federal funding, highway funding. I believe this is the case if you lower the drinking age in a state to under 21. But, you know, this is the tiredest argument of all time, but totally true. You can go to Afghanistan and you can pick the next president of the United States, but you can't have a beer.
Well, I think the drinking age should be 18 for that college reason, but I don't think many people agree with that. Let's go to Kelly in Winchester. What do you think, Kelly?
Oops. Kelly, we'll get to you in a second.
I went to the wrong one. I'm sorry. Dan in the car. Hi, Dan.
Oh, hi. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to call and weigh in. I grew up down in Carver in the Plymouth area, lots of woods and stuff. And when kids couldn't find a place to drink when I was underage, I mean, obviously, I don't approve of it one way or the other. But, you know, they would often go into the woods and have what we called, like, pit parties. And really bad things could happen because there was nobody out there to help. Everybody would be drunk. I had a friend who drank way too much once, turned blue. We had to literally carry him out of the woods, get him to a hospital. Like, kids are going to find a way to drink. I don't approve of parents having him in the house, but they're going to find a way to do it.
So I thought you were going in the opposite direction. I think you were saying it's far better to have him in the house. The odds of them being safe are greater, even if there's an occasional problem, than have him alone in the woods. So what is there a solution or there's none?
I honestly couldn't say one way or the other. I'm just saying people are going to find a way to do it. There were places, houses, where parents were more okay with it where we grew up, and less things happened there than the places where, you know, kids would go drink in, like, an abandoned building in Plymouth, or they'd go drink in the woods, and, like, all kinds of stuff could happen.
Dan, we got it. Thank you so much for the call.
You know, one of the things they do teach, which I think is a great idea, is the buddy system. You know, you're supposed to have, you're in charge, you know, you're in charge of your friend, your friend's in charge of you. So if one of you gets into trouble, the other one is looking out for them.
Well, the other thing is what you mentioned before is teach your own kids how to drink responsibly. I know that sounds so trite and insane.
Yes.
But teach them how to drink.
Slowly. Slowly is the key. How would you find that in your life, Jim? The times when you guzzled those shots? It was not a good situation.
Marjorie, you were talking to a guy who's, you know, half a beer. I am the cheapest per pound whatever in the United States of America, which is actually a good thing. Let's take one more. Judy, you're in Cape Cod. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Judy.
Hi. This actually happened to me. I had four teenage girls at my home, and we found out the next morning there was some clue that there was drinking going on, so we addressed it. And I did call the parents because, as a parent, I would want to know if my child was having unsafe behavior. Nobody seemed to be as upset as I was. The parents were like, yeah, I better talk to them about that. Nobody cared. And I think that's part of the problem.
It's a huge part of the problem.
Banding together. You know, they should be banding together. We should be looking out for the kids together. Nobody cares except me.
Well, that's an upbeat note, Judy. Thank you for the call. No, obviously it's evidence as evidenced by almost all these stories. Yeah. You almost never hear of one of the parents. I mean, that woman, what was the name of the woman from Plastow? Even though there was a bad outcome, her kid's in jail, which is maybe, I think she was implying that's maybe where she belongs to get herself straight. But the vast majority, the problem, the parents don't give a you-know-what.
Well, I think most parents do give a you-know-what. I think sometimes they just fall asleep and they don't realize
that
their downstairs family room is turned into a wild scene.
I'm not talking about your lying former assistant DA friend who said they were asleep upstairs. I'm talking about the parents of the kids who are there. I mean, it is a real serious problem.
It is a real serious problem.
You
got to
do some educating your kids. You got to sort of wean them into this thing. And most parents aren't doing. Let's move on.
I just don't want to be running it. I just don't want to be arrested for running a disorderly house. You know what I mean, Jim? That'd be very embarrassing.
I thought you were going to say a brothel, Marjorie. That's what you got to look in your face like you were searching for that word.
It's not that bad. I don't think I have to worry about being arrested
for that.
Did
you watch Mad Men the last couple of weeks?
No, I did not.
Well,
but you told me it was very good.
A lot of brothel
good.
Talk.
Okay. All right. We'll check that out. Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk about politics, Obamacare, more about underage drinking, too. We're going to ask Charlie Baker what he thinks about underage drinking for teens. He's got a whole slew of them. When he joins us for open mic. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH.